Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's Bookmark, our studio guest is biographer Claire Mulley. She'll be talking about her most recent book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler. We'll also hear from Daisy Johnson, who's writer in residence for the A14. Yes, the A14. And we'll be talking to Karen Freeborn about her novel, presenting The Fabulous O'Learys. But first of all, hello, Claire, and welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But I mentioned that I called you a biographer. Initially, I called you a historian, but then on your website, it says biographer. How do you define yourself?
Historical biographer.
Historical biographer, of course.
They are different things. I think that history is not really the past. History is our relationship with the past. And I suppose history books can provide bridges for us to go back and view the past through our own perspectives. I think that biography are more personal. They're sort of like footbridges, human connections between past and present lives, if you like.
And I was going to ask you if you've ever written fiction, partly just if you've ever written fiction is an interesting question, but also because biographies now and historical books seem to have more fictional extracts sometimes in them. The form seems to be slightly changing.
Yes, and I think, personally, I like to do my research very thoroughly. I like to be accurate, factually accurate. But I recognise that there is more than one kind of truth. There is factual truth. There are also moral truths and emotional truths. And sometimes you have to take a leap of imagination. But I think you need to be clear if you're doing this. Sometimes people like Julian Barnes might write genre-bending books, but he says in the preface, you know, I've done this, but I've fictionalised to this degree. Then you have novelists like Hilary Mantel, who are absolutely fantastic in their research and really present great truths in their books, but they don't pretend to be writing history books. They're writing historical novels. And I think as long as you're clear with the reader, I do find it difficult, though, if a biographer or a historian somehow inserts, without any kind of statement about it, a bit of fictionalised writing in that.
Yeah. And it must be tempting sometimes, because you must almost have all the pieces of the jigsaw there.
Well, not for me. I don't do that. I've never written any fiction and I don't fictionalise in my books. But I think that doesn't stop you from making them dramatic, and the truths themselves can hold, you know, great import, and you can do a lot of reveal through those facts. And occasionally there are gaps in the record, and sometimes those gaps can be telling themselves. Why are there gaps? So there's other ways to look at it.
Well, we're going to talk about your very dramatic book the rest of the show, but we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Oh, children, why have you chosen this one?
I've written three books, and my first book was a biography of Eglantine Jebb, the woman who set up Save the Children and came up with a revolutionary idea that children were human beings and should have human rights. The book's called The Woman Who Saved the Children, and this song is inspired by that.
Pass me that lovely little gun, my dear, my darling one. The cleaners are coming one by one. You don't even wanna let them start.
That's So Children by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Claire Mulley. Claire's first book, The Woman Who Saved the Children, about child rights pioneer Eglantine Jebb, was published in 2009 and won the Daily Mail Biographers Club Prize. Her next, The Spy Who Loved, about Britain's first female special agent of the Second World War, came out in 2012, and the film rights have recently been optioned by Universal Studios. Her third book, published this year, entitled The Women Who Flew for Hitler, examines the lives of Nazi Germany's only two female test pilots, Hannah Riesch and Melita von Stauffenberg. The Spectator described it as well-researched, beautifully written and refreshing. Booklist USA said it was absolutely gripping. First of all, Claire, did I pronounce their names right then?
No.
No, I didn't think so. How should they be pronounced?
Hannah Wright and Melita von Stauffenberg.
Right. OK, thank you for correcting me. Well, just to rewind a little bit, have you always been interested in history?
Always, yes, absolutely. Drawn to it, big family history, although there's no huge achievers and lots of dirt, mud, floors, but nonetheless, there's a bit of a record in our family. I've got my grandmother's plait from 1920. She cut off when she became a flapper.
So, oh, excellent.
Yes, it's always been a huge part of my interest.
And your writing has focused on the women in history.
Yes, I think there's a rich seam of narrative there still waiting to be mined. There, I remember David Starkey famously said, you know, he's a great historian, but he said that if you want to do an honest history of our country more than the last 5 years, it has to be a history of white males because they were the power players. And they may have been largely the power players, but that history isn't exclusively about that. It's our whole rich tapestry. And there are these stories, and pleased to say there is more attention being paid to them about the women, about the Muslims in the Tudor court, about all sorts of things. And that's what makes our story.
And is it harder to find out about women? Presumably because some of the people recording the history were men and because women changed their names, etc.
To a degree it is, yes. But there's also the flip side of that. There is resources that haven't been looked at. So for my latest book, for example, one of the wonderful things I found was a handwritten diary, 1943-1944, so right at the heart of the war, that Melita von Stauffenberg wrote. And it just hasn't really received the attention that it should have done. And it gives us details. You know, we've got her handwritten entry for the 20th of July 1944, when the most famous assassination attempt on Hitler took place. And she's right at the heart of things, and no one's really drawn on that as a resource. So you do find that there are things that have been overlooked because they are women as well, which enables you to have a new perspective, not just on the women's role, but on all of our role, our history.
Well, let's talk about the women who flew for Hitler. When did you first become aware of this story, really?
It took me about 4 years to write the book, so I guess about 5 years ago that I first heard about Hannah Wright. She's much better known, and she's generally presented as being very brave, which she was, a brilliant, brilliant pilot, absolutely was. I think there are still records extant that people haven't overturned that she holds. But generally politically naive, possibly because she was a woman, and she could almost have been fighting on the other side, you know, it's just unfortunate. And I was very interested to find new letters that haven't been looked at all, unpublished, which really shows that she did share that Nazi worldview. She was deeply anti-Semitic, quite fanatical. And it was fascinating to look again at her story with this fresh evidence. But I hadn't heard at all about this other woman, Melita Schiller, as she called herself, Melita von Stauffenberg. She married into the famous family. And it was absolutely wonderful to bring these two stories together. Two women, they flew, learnt to fly over the same green slopes, knew each other throughout the war. The only two women to work as test pilots for the Nazi regime. If they weren't phenomenally skilled as women, they would never have been given these roles. It must have cost the regime something to acknowledge that. And yet they loathed each other. And they took very different decisions. They had very different perspectives and ended their lives on opposite sides of history, but right at the centre of that World War II story. And that hadn't been addressed. And that was absolutely remarkable.
They did meet each other, didn't they?
Yes, yes. I mean, as the only two female test pilots, they were working from some of the same air bases. They would both go to the Berlin Air Club. There was a bar there, the casinos. So they spent a lot of time together. And there are recordings of them, you know, very terse little conversations. They wouldn't take a cup of tea with each other. And Hannah certainly vocally put Melita down at every opportunity. She would talk about her unfortunate ambition that was perhaps the result of her unfortunate bloodline. And, you know, she was very...
This was because of her Jewish heritage.
That's right. Yeah. So she would expose that and expose Melita repeatedly to danger because of that. She accused her of making a pass at her, anything she could think of to undermine her. So, yes, they knew each other very well.
And the photographs in the book, I mean, even physically, they're very different, aren't they? And actually, of the two, Hannah always looks the friendliest. She's a big smile, nice big eyes. She always looks nice and open. Although, you know, arguably she was the most objectionable of the two.
Arguably, absolutely was the most objectionable. I mean, this is one of the nice things that I enjoyed finding with the book. When you start, Hannah is a bubbly young schoolgirl. She's defiant. She kind of breaks down your gender expectations. She's a proto-feminist to some. I don't know if you can be a racist and a feminist, but anyhow, she certainly pushes her right as a person, irrespective of the fact that of gender, to do the work in the airfields and doing the test work that the men were doing. And you really like her for that. And one of the wonderful things is that history isn't black and white. There are greys, and she's an interesting, complex, difficult woman. So, you know, I certainly quite liked her at first. And then you meet Melitta, and she's older, she's more restrained. She's trying to stay out of the limelight anyhow, so she's not effusive with the press because she's trying to keep a low profile because of her family ancestry. But she's more conservative. She's got this old school. She does all her amazing test work, and then she comes home and puts her pinny on and cooks dinner for her husband, who's an academic. So she sees herself as an exception rather than trying to... She pulls up the ladder behind her. She's not trying to make a gender case. So she's a much more sort of less attractive initially, but she is much more principled. And, you know, they both had this incredible physical courage, but Melitta had moral courage and Hannah had none of that. And I see them as the story evolves. They're sort of, I see them like two aeroplanes spiralling around, like DNA, if you like, spiralling upwards, circling each other, but always at a distance. And your perspective on them, hopefully, as you read the book, will change as your opinions evolve.
Because they both met Hitler.
They both met Hitler.
And Hitler was spoke a lot about both of them. I mean, certainly saw Hannah, didn't he, as a kind of poster girl.
He did. And Hannah was delighted to be used by the regime. So she's on collectible cigarette cards. Nazi star of beauty. Strange combination of words there. Both of them served in the Olympics. They weren't competitors, but they served in the flight days doing demonstrations. Hannah became the first woman in the world to fly a helicopter, and in fact, the first person in the world to fly a helicopter inside a building as part of a PR event for the Third Reich before the war, 38. And she's very keen to lend her name and her face to all the propaganda films during the war and so on. So you see her on Hitler's birthday concert. The camera will zone in on her in the crowd, you know, almost in tears. So she was, yeah, very willing to support the regime in any way she could. Melitta, much less of that. There is one talk she eventually has to give, but you can see she's got out of it as much as she can. She never wants to lend her name to the regime. And even when she does give this publicity talk in Sweden, she never uses the word Hitler, she never uses the word Nazi or National Socialism. It's very much a personal telling, talking about her country is besieged at war. War changes our perspective on everything, and it has this awful momentum of its own. So when your country has been bombed, you rise to the defence as a patriot. But for her country, not for the regime. She makes a distinction that Hannah never does.
Thank you, Claire. We're going to come back to you and talk just more about the times that in which the book was set and the research that you had to do for that. But we'll take a slight diversion now in every sense of the word. Daisy Johnston is the A14's first writer in residence, a librarian, children's writer and blogger from York. She took up the post created by the University of Cambridge Institute of Continuing Education earlier this year. When I met her, I asked the obvious question. Where's your desk going to be? On a lay-by? At a junction?
Well, technically, no. I am based at the Institute of Continuing Education at Madingley, and my desk is in there, safe and tucked away from any cars.
And do you need to go and visit the A14 for inspiration?
Well, every time I come down to it, I come down from York, so I travel there and back on the A14. So I kind of get my fix and get back into the zone of thinking about what I need to be doing when I'm travelling here and there.
And what does a writer in residence do?
So this project's really interesting because it's based around the road, the A14, and it's based around the idea of getting creativity maybe somewhere where you don't sort of necessarily see it before. So what I do is I write, first of all, but I also go out and talk to a lot of people and I try and find out their stories about the A14. I'm not from the area, so a great thing is that I can kind of be a blank slate. So I kind of want to hear stories that are good or bad, or I'm very keen to have a spaceship at some point. I would very much enjoy a spaceship-based story.
And do people have stories about the A14?
Yeah, well, I've heard about a bull that was released onto on the A14. I've heard about relationships that have been made on the A14 that have been broken on the A14.
Oh, my goodness.
People driving to see their loved ones driving away. people moving down to London was another one that was quite an interesting one, using the A14 as kind of this marker of their home, of where they were from, and recognising it when they came back. So yeah, there's a lot there. I think it's just listening and finding out these things and talking to people.
And there's always been a tradition amongst poets of writing about roads and travelling as a metaphor for life and for many other things.
The idea of the road is really interesting in itself, because you don't ever go to a road from choice as a location. You always are travelling somewhere, coming back from something. You don't ever really consider the idea of this road as being a relevant site of interest in its own right. So, of course, it leads to all these ideas about life and growth and journeys and moving on and moving back and kind of understanding where you are and where you've been. The richness of what can be found in there, yeah, it's a massive thing.
Well, you say moving on, but the A14 is notorious for being clogged up and congested. Are you going to reflect that in the poetry?
Yeah, definitely. I've been talking to some people, and that is one of the common things, I do not deny, comes up. But again, that's really interesting that people can start translating that moment of being stuck in traffic to maybe thinking, okay, I'm looking out the window, I don't know, can I find something inspirational from this?
And roads, we think, the A14 in particular, it's not a particularly scenic route, it's not a particularly pretty road, but you can produce beautiful things out of this?
Yes. I tell you what, on the Facebook group that we've got up to share these stories, I had a submission from an 8-year-old boy called William, who sent me a story all about dragons racing up and down the A14, which is brilliant, just flipping it on its head and seeing the kind of potential in this space. And the long straight stretches were where the dragons raced, and when the lights dimmered, there was magic happening, and just thought it was amazing.
That does sound amazing. So you can go anywhere with your imagination. It just
exactly
has to be A14 centred.
Yeah, or even just roads, journeys, that idea, just something that spins off the idea of a road. I'm not going to pin you down to this happened in the services one day, but, you know, use your imagination and kind of think, what if? That's what I was telling some children that I was chatting to the other day. What if an alien comes down and lands a spaceship? What if you woke up one morning and there were no cars on the road? Those kind of questions that you can start asking yourself and going, okay, maybe can I find a story here?
So what's the kind of outline of the work? How will it shape itself? Is it a year project?
So my part in it is only for 6 weeks or so, but then the project goes on to do some free creative writing classes. The big thing about those is that we're really interested in people that don't necessarily think creative writing is for them. I don't want anyone to think that they can't write or that they shouldn't be allowed to write, because writing is one of those great things that has no privilege about it. You can go out and pick up a pen and you can tell a story. And I think these creative writing classes are a great opportunity, especially if you've never thought that you can participate in that sort of thing. They're all free. You can find the details through our Facebook or our social media. I'd really encourage people who don't think it's necessarily for them to kind of give it a bit of a risk and come along.
So following the creative writing classes, will there be work published that's coming out of this project?
Yeah, we're putting together an anthology which is going to be launched at Maddingley next year at some point. And that's going to have the best work. So I am lobbying quite hard for the dragon story to go in because it's one of my favourites. But it's kind of going to compile everything that we've come across during this and be a reflection of local people's interests and kind of how they see the road now at this point when it's not quite finished, but it's not quite what it was, this point in between. And I think that's really exciting. I'm interested to see where it ends up.
And as you say, you're from York, so you're discovering the A14 yourself in this project. What have you discovered about it?
I have discovered that it's not a road that doesn't have reaction. People react to it. I think that's really interesting. There's always something. And I think that quite gut emotional reaction is really exciting, in that you can always shape something if you have it. And that for writing is really key. So when you don't have that emotional investment, you don't have that connection to somewhere, that you can't work with. So, you know, this emotion, this reaction is brilliant, and I find it fascinating.
This is a significant route, isn't it? If you were saying to people you're a writer in residence for the A123, you know, you might get a different reaction.
I imagine so, yeah. But the A14 is very present in a lot of people's heads, and I think that's, again, a blessing and a curse, because you can't deny it has sort of issues at the moment. But I think it's just exciting to be able to maybe translate those reactions into something creative and making and something positive from it.
And what's your background? How did you get to be involved in this?
I am a researcher from the University of York. I'm in the final stages of a degree in the representation of landscape and space and place in children's books. I look at what it means to have a hill in a book as opposed to a lake, and what these kind of indications of a space and landscape mean for the children at the heart of the books. I also blog and write children's books myself. So yeah, I caught eye of this and I thought it could have quite an interesting connection to what I was doing. Came down and had a chat with them and found out a bit more about it and thought, yeah, there's really kind of unique opportunity here to explore.
Does the A14 feature in any children's books?
There's a really interesting representation of the A14 kind of distantly in Alexia Casale's House of Windows, which is a book that's for young adults, so teenagers. It's set in and around Cambridge, and the A14 kind of is referenced when the characters go out punting and rowing, the river curving round in the A14 in the distance. So that's one of the more local ones. The other big author of local interest is, from my perspective of children's, is probably Philippa Pierce, who is a queen of children's books, and something like Tom's Midnight Garden is still so crucial, but that's all set around here in the Fens and that kind of area. So yeah, there's a real rich literary history. So yeah, it's been really exciting kind of finding out these little pots of story, as I say. Yeah.
In terms of the work that you've had in, because I know you've been garnering work really through Facebook page, through social media, you've got some examples that you can share with us?
I can certainly share one of mine if that's...
Yeah, that's great.
I got a little delirious as I was driving down once as I was stuck in traffic on the A14, and I was thinking, well, what could happen here? And at my interview, I'd spoken about Emily Dickinson, because I'm really interested in how her poetry with the dashes kind of has a connection to roads with their markings on the road. And I was kind of interested in how that could maybe work something, and in my delirium it started to make sort of sense. So this was The Hitchhiker Just Past Junction 23. She climbs into my car around Junction 23, where I've been stuck for the last 30 minutes staring at the side of a Spanish lorry. She's got dark hair, and the rain has soaked it to the side of her head, and the bones on her face stand proud. She introduces herself as Emily, and then pauses and says, "Emily Dickinson," which is surprising. And so I say, "Really?" and try to remember how to speak Spanish, even though I can't. She sighs. I say, "You're dead. Don't give me that." And my hitchhiker, who thinks she is a dead poet that barely left her room for years, rolls her eyes at me as though she's 12. "You thought I'd be blonde," she says. "That you were blonde," I say. "Semantics," she sounds smug. "Don't deny the fact that you didn't know." "I'm not doing this," I say, as the traffic starts to move and my heart beats as my hand reaches for second gear. "Why did you think I'd be blonde?" "An urge to defy cultural stereotypes," I say. "Or perhaps too much Little Women." She nods knowingly. "You thought I'd be an Amy," she says. "I'm a Beth." "Oh, Beth," I say. And for a moment, I think about letting her stay for maybe forever, but then she gestures at the white lines on the road and says, "They stole this from me." "It's just paint," I say. "Nothing is ever just anything," says Emily Dickinson. "Pull over." And even though I've hit 30 for the first time in weeks, I do. I watch her get out and stride towards a Spanish lorry that's already pulling in for her.
That's Daisy Johnson, writer in residence for the A14. And if you're interested in finding out more, then search A14 Stories on Facebook. You're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers. Studio guest is historical biographer Claire Mulley. Claire, just talking about the times in which your most recent book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler, is set. It's very important to get that right, isn't it? Because it was not only a pioneering age for air flight, but also a time of unemployment, inflation, all the conditions that allowed Hitler to rise to power, basically.
That's absolutely right, yes. And what's interesting about that is my book is about two very different women, and they have very different perspectives on that context and the times. So in the 1930s, Hannah Reich sees bunting and parades, marching bands, and she sees pledges about jobs, work, the restoration of national pride after the defeat and what she saw as the humiliation of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Whereas Melitta has a very different perspective. She sees a society under attack she sees the reduction of rights for people, particularly the Jewish population, increasingly. And of course, she found out in probably around 1937 when the Nuremberg Laws came in, which enshrined racial discrimination into German law. She found out that her family, her father, had been born Jewish, although he'd converted to Protestantism as a young man. And so she sees this very personally, but she also sees, you know, increasing intolerance in different ways, violence on the streets and so on. So they have very, very different perspectives. And I think it's important that you look at both of those. You have to be compassionate, but you have to be critical as well. And that's the context in which this story starts.
And given that you are telling two stories, really, as well as the story of a nation during a certain period of time, and two very different stories, but with links, how do you balance that? Because they're very different. How do you transition, if you like, from one story to another?
But in a sense, it's not that difficult, because we talk about this dichotomy in society, these two very different perspectives. But of course, for most people, they see a bit of both. You know, you see the bunting, but then you see the fear. You want to see the positive. You're kind of anchored in hope, and you want to see your nation changing for the better. But obviously, there are concerns, and you know your neighbour next door is having a different experience and so on. And so the complexity of it is something really enjoyable to work with, and the fact that it's not a black and white story. And so the stories of the two women cross over at many, many different junctions, not just because they meet, they work at the same places, they meet, they're in the same newspaper articles, they've met for the same photo shoots, but also because they respond very differently to things like Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, when there were the attacks on the synagogues, Jewish shops and houses, and Jewish residents, including elderly residents in their pyjamas, were pulled out and beaten, and there were deaths. And they respond to that. So you have their same perspectives on this changing national story.
OK, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Spies by Coldplay. Why this one?
My second book was about Christine Scarbeck, or Christine Granville, who was the first woman to work for Britain as a special agent behind enemy lines in the Second World War. Wonderful woman.
I awake to find no peace of mind. I said, how do you live as a fugitive down here where I cannot see so clear? I said, what do I know? Show me the right way to go. And the spies came out of the water. But you're feeling so bad, 'cause you know that the spies hide out in every corner.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is historical biographer Claire Mulley, talking about her book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler. It's a big old book, Claire. How long did that take you to research?
The whole process took me about 4 years. But, you know, I do this around, I've got my three daughters at home, so I kind of juggle things. But the research kind of almost goes the whole way through, because yeah, I'm always open to finding that new bit of information and weaving it in, or perhaps changing things as a result of that. So, yes, the research is fantastic.
As I say, you need to enjoy the research, really, don't you?
I love it. You know, I'm a very nosy person, and I suppose inquisitive is the politer word for that. And the wonderful thing about being a biographer is, in a sense, it gives you a license to, you know, delve into public archives or between the lines of private letters. And I went out to Germany a couple of times, and I interviewed family members and veterans who, you know, both British veterans who knew the women, or in fact, German Luftwaffe officers as well, who were very generously shared their time and their memories and perspectives with me, which was absolutely fascinating.
And how does it feel reading letters and diaries and that kind of thing?
fantastic. I mean, Melitta's diaries are with her family and a German historical writer as well. And they were very happy to share them. They felt that her story, I mean, they rightly feel that her story should be out there. In fact, Melitta's sister, Clara, who was very close to her, was going to write a biography of Melitta in the 1970s. And she put an advert in the German papers saying if anyone, you know, who remembers stories would like to contribute. And Hannah Reich saw these adverts and got in touch and basically put Clara off. She said, you know, her ambition was caused by her racial burden and, you know, horrendous things. And she said, it would be much terrible if the truth came out. And in a way, it was wonderful to be able to refute that and finally bring this other side out.
And how is your German?
Not good enough. So I have a number of my husband is from a German family. So there are various people. His brother lives over there. So there are various people who very kindly work with me because you have to absolutely, if you're quoting, you need to make sure you've got the nuance right. So I was very careful with that process.
Well, it is an issue, isn't it? Because some of these documents are vital to your research and you want to make sure you've got it right.
Exactly. Especially if there are, you know, we have a document where Hannah accuses Melitta of making a pass at her. Well, I needed to be sure what kind of a pass. You know, those sorts of things, you really need to get the nuance correct.
And you've described research in biography as a sense of shaking hands or joining a conversation across history. Is there always a point at which you feel some sort of connection with your subject?
Yes, for me personally, there is. It's not necessarily... I really admired Eglantine Jebb and Christina Scarbeck. These women, it's a different thing. And I think there is this sort of perhaps a naive sense of identification because everyone is human. So they all have these things that you relate to. And that accessibility is really important. But I think you have to draw back as well and be objective and not just sort of run with a very early formed perspective on them. But yes, it is a sense of shaking hands across history. And, you know, a couple of the gentlemen I interviewed the eldest son of Klaus von Stauffenberg, the man who's famous for the attempted bomb plot against Hitler in The Wolf's Lair, played by Tom Cruise in the film Valkyrie. And his eldest son, you know, remembered all this, remembered his aunt very well, obviously remembered his father and had these fantastic stories. And shaking his hand, he said, you know, you're just one handshake away from Hitler because my father, we have this photograph of him about to shake Hitler's hand. But of course, that wasn't shaking his hand willingly. Whereas I also interviewed Eric Brown, who's a fantastic British naval pilot, a man who's flown more planes, more different types of plane than any other man, and I think ever will in history because we don't make so many different sorts now. Sadly, he died quite recently. Anyhow, I interviewed him a number of times at his home, and again, shaking his hand. You know, I shook Hannah Wright's hand, and she shook Hitler's hand many a time. And again, just one step away, one handshake away, but on the other side. And that was a pretty sobering thought, really.
Yes, you're living with these people for quite a long time, aren't you? And not just those people, but their circle as well. So you need to not necessarily like them, do you? But be interested and fascinated from them. It needs to be an interest that can be sustained.
Obsessed, I think. Yes, my poor patient husband has been very kind. I'm looking up, you know, what the equivalent price would have been for cigarettes and find that absolutely fascinating, whatever. Yes, I think it's, I get totally obsessed with their stories and very, very involved with it. But again, you do have to draw out. I mean, a story, when you're writing about a story set in the Third Reich, and I'm writing about individual personal stories, you have to put them in that context. And this is a regime that is rightly known for its appalling crimes against humanity. And that context was relevant. This is stuff that, to a degree, they were somewhere between culpable and complicit. And you have to bring it into that context as well.
And your learning curve as well. I mean, you must have learnt an awful lot about aviation.
I know, a bit more than I did, yes. I went up in a glider in France as well. I wanted to get that. I must say, in retrospect, perhaps it's best not to make notes while you're going up in a glider. We had to come down quite quickly. But yes, I got very involved. And I now find all of that quite fascinating as well.
And what you do convey beautifully in the book is the passion that they both had for flight. And we talked about fictional writing. It's not really fictional writing. It's just beautifully poetic writing about
that
flight inspires, that it inspired in them and that it inspired in yourself. That's almost like exercising a different writing skill, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose. Well, you have to have empathy, and empathy involves a degree of imagination and so on. But yes, I do my best to do all the research, and that includes the physical research of going in a glider fight to get a sense of what that feeling was, although mine was a much more safe machine. You know, originally, these women were going in very basic wood
canvas machines that were put together. They'd sit on a plank, they'd have to try and balance it on the green slopes, and then they'd get towed down the slopes by two lines of young men pulling rubber tow cords, you know, wearing knitted jerseys. And then they'd flick the tow rope would go spiralling away across the sky, and they'd leave the contours of the earth in sight. But of course, when you fly, you're above the world. And Hannah Reich would later talk about being above politics, just being this, you know, this interconnected. And there was this huge hope in this glamorous age of flight in the 1930s that flight would connect continents, countries, and be this hope for peace. And of course, it was brought into the military. Well, it was in the First World War, but, you know, even more so, and became something very different.
Well, we'll find out in just a moment what happened to Hannah and Melita, but we'll take a diversion now into fiction to hear from Karen Freeborn. Karen is a poet and novelist. Her latest novel, Presenting the Fabulous O'Learys, is about an eccentric family fighting with and for one another, despite a series of never-ending fractures. Marion Keyes said of it, "It's about the pain of being alive, and yet it's so, so funny." Told from multiple perspectives, it's set in 1984. I asked Karen why she'd chosen to set it then.
There's several reasons, but the most important one is because everyone in it has a difference, and a lot of people have what would now be called a disability. And I didn't want everyone in it to have a diagnosis, and I didn't want them to be able to self-diagnose. I didn't want other people to be able to diagnose them. I didn't want access to Google, basically. Then, of course, it gets interesting because I've said it with a theatrical family, there's a particular crumbling of a certain kind of theatre that happens around that time as well. And then lots of other things you can bring into play. And I was young then and got a certain nostalgia for it. But the main reason is no Google, no mobile phones.
Well, let's talk about those differences that you mentioned in the characters. Each of the characters does have a tick or a difference, a tick in cases. Why?
Because the world is structured for the neurotypical. The world is structured for what we call normal. And I wanted to say, what if you don't fit in there? What if you don't? What if you're one of those, one of us, because I'm neurodiverse myself, one of those who don't fit in? What happens to you? And why can't you see yourself in literature? That's an aside, but that seemed to me important. And what happens as well if your difference is not something that you can recognise and put a label on? And I think for a lot of us who didn't receive a diagnosis as a child, we know what it means to feel really weird and then think, oh, actually, no, I'm not weird. Set against this set of criteria, I am perfectly normal. Thank you very much. So there was all that going on. And also, it's just fun to write, to be honest. Who wants to write yet another novel about a nice white middle class family going through some sort of petty dysfunction? I mean, if I was going to do dysfunction, I wanted to really do dysfunction, you know. And they're fun.
And neurodiverse, which you mentioned there, what does that mean?
It means somewhere on the autism spectrum, but it can also have to do with related conditions such as dyspraxia. I'm not dyspraxic, although anyone who's seen me riding my bike around Cambridge might dispute that. It basically means that your brain patterns don't quite fire like most people's. In terms of diagnosis, it's 1 in 100. But of course, it's going to be more than that in reality. But even 1 in 100 is a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot. And when you're writing characters like that, I guess you have to be quite careful because there are funny elements. You know, these things do, well, you have somebody who's got Tourette's.
Yeah.
It is funny, you know, how you tread a line, a careful line.
Do you know what it is? It's inhabiting it from the inside. I'm never, ever laughing at my characters. I'm doing funny stuff so that we can laugh with them. And actually, sometimes the things that make us laugh are also going to be the things that make us think. And I think that's really important. Some of the things that happen to Tom because of his Tourette's make us culpable as readers, I think, you know. And that's an interesting and, I hope, sometimes uncomfortable place for the reader to be.
You want your readers to feel a bit uncomfortable?
Sometimes, yeah. It's basically a version of King Lear. Although, as my publisher says, with more laughs and fewer eye gougings.
Yeah, that's good.
And we're supposed to feel uncomfortable with tragedy. It seems to me that tragedies, even funny tragedies, ask what it means to be fully human. I mean, the answers are going to change. I mean, it's not a trans-historical thing because the answers are going to change over time, but the question remains the same. And that, it seems to me, has to be an uncomfortable question. Otherwise, we're not even beginning to face potential answers.
And you've written from four perspectives.
Yeah, that's right.
On a practical level, how did you do that? Did you write one perspective all the way through, or did you hop from perspective to perspective?
I hopped. Each perspective is a chapter. I thought if I do it in smaller chunks than that, I think it's going to feel too much like head hopping, and I didn't want that. But it wasn't that difficult. Once you have the voices, I mean, I'm all about the voice anyway. I mean, as you know, I'm a poet as well. And my poetry is also all about characters' voices. And my earlier novels were as well. Once you've established that, it's quite easy to inhabit that for a chapter and then move on. But I'm an obsessive rewriter as well.
And was there a favourite character that you liked to write?
It shifted, depending on what was happening. I really loved writing Delia. I really loved writing her. But Raquel's fun to write as well, and Ken the patriarch, the theatrical Ken, who of course wants to both retire and not retire, exactly like King Lear, you know, who wanted to retain the name and all the addition to a king. Well, how does that work then? You're either a king or you're not a king, you know. So he was fun. Eddie, who is clearly the Edmund figure, the bad boy figure, he was the most challenging one to write, I think. Partly because he's a man, but then so is Ken. And partly because I knew I was playing with a character who might or might not be liked by the audience. And that's always a risk, you know, because he does some very naughty things.
He is very naughty.
He is, yes.
And the central character, in a way, the central character, the one who they all revolve around, says nothing.
Yes. Yeah.
Obviously a very deliberate choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And the brilliant cover designed by Jo Dalton, who I don't know at all. She just managed to plug into mine and my editor's vision. It was amazing. If you notice, the Glenn character on the front of the cover is bigger than the others. And there's this huge silent presence in the novel. Yeah.
Did you know what he was thinking?
No. No. He is a mystery to me too. I think that's right. I knew what he represented symbolically, and I knew how powerful silence can be. I mean, there's a lot of silence both explicitly talked about and not explicitly talked about in King Lear. So silence was always going to be important, and the things we don't and can't say are always going to be important. But also who we measure ourselves against. And I think everyone in the novel kind of measures themselves against Glenn. He's a kind of repository for all their angst, really.
And there is something in the book about family. There's something about the importance of family and the strength of family, even though this is a family that at times is ripping itself apart.
Yeah, yeah. Nearly everybody comes from a family, don't they? Even people who are only very nominally attached to their families. That in itself is a relationship that's always interesting to explore. And this is a family, the O'Learys do love each other. They do. And they've got this weird codependency, really. And the fact that it's dysfunctional, but they manage to exist within it, I think is something that a lot of people can relate to.
And it was a message, obviously, that you wanted to deliver.
Yeah, absolutely, that family matters and we can't escape them no matter what.
And it seems to me that this is ripe for a sequel.
Do you know, I never even thought of that, to be honest. I doubt very much I'll write a sequel. I am very much the person, and I think this is probably an autistic thing, really. Well, I'm done with that, on to the next thing, because that was then. And yeah, so I doubt it. But the reviews are starting to trickle in on Amazon now. People are going, no, I wanted to know what's going to happen to so-and-so, you know.
Yeah, you do leave it at quite on a bit of a cliff edge.
I do, but people have to read the book to find out what that edge is.
So what is this next thing that you're doing then?
I have an idea for a novel. I'm quite surprised that I have an idea for a novel because I didn't think I was going to write another novel because I'm primarily a poet these days. I'm not going to say too much about it because I don't want it to slip through my fingers. Do you know I'm at that stage with it? But it's very character-based. I've just got these sort of crazy characters, including a belly dancer in my mind, which I want to use. And it's a backward structure, so it will start at its end and end at its beginning.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I don't like to make things easy for myself.
That sounds great. And as a poet and using language and words, using them in a different way when you're writing prose, how did that feel?
It felt kind of strange at first because although I started as a novelist, that was like a long time ago now, But I think because my poetry is so character-based by and large, it was just like making bigger versions of that in a way. Again, having four voices helped with that, I think, because I could capture moments more easily, although, of course, it had to be narratively compelled as well.
And it's a very visual book. I can see it's a screenplay, actually.
Do you know, that would be lovely, wouldn't it? Do you know what I think it could be? I think it could be a telly series. I could see it as a four-part telly series or a three-part telly series, something like that. But clearly that's a dream.
And presenting The Fabulous O'Learys by Karen Freeborn is published by Holland Hess. Well, Claire, Mully, Karen there talking about screenplays. One of your books has been optioned, hasn't it, for a film?
It has, yes. It's very exciting. Universal Studios have optioned it. And yes, so far it's all looking quite good. There's been an expression of interest in the lead role, which is Angelina Jolie.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, she's not signed the line yet, but yes, we're all very excited.
That is very exciting. Well, let's round off the stories of Melita and Hannah. One of the things that struck me reading the book was the sacrifices they made to their health and their future. Neither of them had children, I'm right in remembering.
Neither had children, no.
So there's no descendants from them still around, you know, direct descendants.
No, there's family members from both, though. Hannah's brother had children, and Melita's family, she's got lots of nephews and nieces, many of whom got involved with my research and were very supportive of the project. So,
and the women are still remembered in Germany, are they?
Hannah Wright, she's fairly well known, and she's quite well known over here if you're a bit of a nerd like me now. So she appears as a character in Downfall and Operation Crossbow, the 1960s film with Sophia Loren. She's a small character in that, although completely historically inaccurately. But so she's quite well known. Melita has pretty much disappeared from history. I mean, she's better known in Germany. There has been German work about her, but not really. And the family are very keen that this book is translated into German. We've got a couple of publishers having a look at the moment, so fingers crossed on that.
And did they leave a legacy? Is there something that you can put your finger on and say they left a legacy? I mean, Hannah in particular, was it, said that she wasn't keen on teaching girls after the war to flies, but presumably by doing it, she did set an example.
I think she has been held up as an example for young men and women. But yes, she had an interesting life after the war without giving too much away. She went out to Ghana and she taught the pioneering glider, future military gliders out there. So yes, I mean, she has some legacies, although that was all overturned in the revolution later anyhow. I think Melita perhaps, ironically, had more of a legacy. Melita's, one of the things that she achieved, after the bomb plot, she was arrested, as were most of the von Stauffenberg family, including her husband, who was serving in Greece and clearly nothing to do with it. They were all imprisoned. And Melita managed amazingly to do a deal with the regime. She was so brilliant. Her skills were exceptional. She was a leading aeronautical engineer as well as a test pilot, one of the few engineers who tested her own machines. So she led on the development of dive sights for the bombers and wing flaps and so on, dive visors. And this is the Stuka dive bombers. So these are the machines that were really symbolic of the Blitzkrieg in the early years of the war. And then later on, she goes on and develops night landing techniques and so on. Her work is absolutely pioneering, leading edge, and they need her. So she does a deal with them and they agree that she can be, after 6 weeks, she's released from prison and she has to be back at her desk that evening. And she is. But after that, her work is not her concern. And she said she even managed to negotiate terms. She said she would go back and do the work, but she insisted on having the right to visit the von Stauffenberg family. So she's in the daytime, she's doing her work. And then as soon as that part of her work is over, she goes out onto the airfields and starts shooting rabbits. And she collects blankets and sheets and food, biscuits, anything she can get her hands on. And she flies over to the concentration camps. And it's just extraordinary. Occasionally, she's allowed to land under these terms she's negotiated, and she hands them over to her husband at Buchenwald. They're in the VIP section, I should say, but nonetheless, when she can't land, she drops stuff down and she just circles above the camps trying to give hope. But she also manages to negotiate to find out where the children are being kept. So the children of Klaus von Stauffenberg, of his elder brother Berthold, have all been taken away. Their names have been changed. They're put in a Nazi orphanage because they're of good German stock, so they think they can be re-educated. And it's because of her that we know where they were. And she managed to get message to her sister-in-law, who is in Ravensbrück concentration camp in isolation, even though she's heavily pregnant. And that's how the family found out where they were. And those children were reunited with their family after the war. And they went on to serve in the German government and in the European government and to reshape a better Germany after the war. So her legacy is really something quite substantial.
They are extraordinary women. I can hear in your voice, you know, you talk about them with such enthusiasm. How hard was it to let them go?
Well, yeah, I don't want to give the whole story away. I mean, it's worth reading to the end of the book. And there are moments when I found out, I didn't know what happened to Melita. I didn't know her story. And it's not perhaps what you might expect. And it is extraordinary. And, you know, there are moments I shed tears when I was researching this. You do get involved. And I think you have to get involved. And then you have to draw back again. But yes, I don't think they'll ever leave me, really, for better and worse.
And I think you're going to be all secret squirrel about this next question, but what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I would be secret squirrel if I knew. So I've been very busy since the book came out. Obviously, I've been doing a bit of a book tour, and I've been a judge for the Historical Writers Association Nonfiction Prize. So just read 55 books for that. And the winner was announced last week.
And you read them?
Of course I did. And it was absolutely fantastic because I read outside of my genre, outside of my normal sort of time in history. Absolutely love that. So that's been fantastic. But I am going back into it now. I've said in January I really got to get involved. So I'm thinking Cold War. So if any of your listeners have got Cold War stories, please let me know.
Let Claire Mully know. And we'll finish by asking you what we ask every guest on Bookmark. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading Cold War histories.
You're preparing.
Yes, biographies of Marcus Wolff, who was the head of the Stasi, and general contextual histories, and getting very excited about it.
Some people wouldn't consider that light relief. What do you do to relax?
Dance in the kitchen.
Oh, that's fine. As long as we know you've got it. You've got an escape valve if you need to. We'll come back to you in just a moment to find out your final choice of music. But let me give you a heads up as to what's on our next show. Our studio guest on the next Bookmark is Preeti Taneja. She'll be talking about her acclaimed debut novel, We That Are Young. We'll also hear from Eleanor Mannion from Piku Publishing, and University Challenge superstars Eric Monkman and Bobby Siegel will be talking about their new quiz book that they've written together, all just in time for Christmas, of course. But we'll sign out now, Claire, with your last choice of music, which is a Beatles track. It's Blackbird. Why this one?
Well, I have always loved this song. My other two bits were in relation to the music that we've played. There isn't, you know, I'm writing about Nazi women. It's a very different book. It's not a celebration of their lives. It's an investigation, although there are things to celebrate in that book. There's also that it's a mixed book. So this is a song. It's about flight, which obviously was relative to these women's lives. But it's also about vision and sight and seeing with focus and breadth. And I think this is something that relates to the book too.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird.